Good morning, everybody. Thanks for having me again. I know that you didn't have anything to do with having me again, but apparently you didn't send enough negative feedback to Phil the last few times I was here that he couldn't invite me back, so I appreciate that. If you have a Bible or an iPad or an iPhone or an whatever with a Bible app on it, why don't you go to Matthew chapter 7 this morning? If you don't have a Bible, no big deal. We're going to put the screen or the text on the screen up here as well. Matthew chapter 7. So the thing is that Pastor Phil gave me a terrible text to preach from this morning. Nobody likes this text. That's why he gave it to me. This is the redheaded stepchild of Bible texts. This is the awful frame that your best friend's mom gave you as a wedding present, and you just kind of like can't throw it away. This is the sweater that your aunt made you at her knitting for beginners class at the community center, and she thinks it's beautiful, and you see her at Easter, and she's like, "Oh, you should have worn the sweater." You know, that's what this text kind of is. It's nobody wants to preach on this text, which is why Phil gave it to me. Phil's the pastor. He has to answer your emails. I'm not the pastor. I get to ignore your emails, which is the best part about not being the pastor. So here's my email address on the screen. I look forward to ignoring your email. Unless you want to email me and say, "That was awesome." And then I'll reply and say, "I know, right?" But seriously, if you have questions after the message, if there's anything I can pray about for you, if God uses this message to knock something loose in your head or in your heart, and you just want me to pray about something, or even if you want to, you know, process it out loud, if you want to talk, have coffee with somebody, and you don't like Phil or don't trust him, I'm happy to have coffee with you. It'd be my pleasure. So shoot me an email. Okay, so here we go. Matthew chapter 7. I'm going to start reading in verse 13 and go down to verse 23 from the New International Version. If you have some other version of the Bible, don't sweat it. You probably won't go to hell for that. Okay, verse 13. This is Jesus talking. This whole passage is Jesus talking, okay? He says, "Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow is the road that leads to life, and only a few find it." How many have heard that passage before? Most, even if you haven't grown up in church, most people are familiar with those two verses. Verse 15, "Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them." Verse 21, scariest passage in the Bible, I think. "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many," that's the scariest word in the Bible to me, "many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and drive out demons and in your name perform many miracles?' Then I will tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.'" So that's some scary stuff. Apparently there are quite a few people who think they're on Jesus' team, that they're Jesus' buddies, that Jesus is their homeboy, and in the end, Jesus is going to say to them, "Who are you?" That's why nobody likes this text. That's why nobody wants to preach this text, Phil. So here's how I want to come at this morning. I want to focus in on verses 13 and 14, the two verses that most people know best, because if you understand verses 13 and 14, the rest of it becomes pretty understandable pretty quick. Verses 15 to 23 mainly just explain and unpack and illustrate what Jesus says in verses 13 and 14. And so Jesus uses these kind of word pictures and this warning to explain everything in 13 and 14. Make sense? So here's a couple questions I think that we should be thinking about. Just a couple key questions to keep us organized and on track. And I think if we understand these questions, we'll understand what Jesus is saying. So first of all, question one, what is the narrow gate in verse 13? This is one of those passages, I think, that we're so, at least people who've grown up in church and have read the Bible quite a bit, we're so familiar with these verses that we don't pause much to think about what is the narrow gate exactly. Okay, so is it, is it Jesus? Is it believing in God? Is it living a good life? What is it exactly? Second question is a question I think a lot of people in our culture are asking these days, and probably plenty of people in this room are asking as well. And the question is, why would I want to find the narrow gate and walk through it? Like, what's in that for me? I respect Jesus and all that. I'm all about the love your enemies and love your neighbor thing. I like that. I just don't think I really want to get religion. I don't want the limitations that I would have to take on my life if I get serious about following Jesus. You know what I mean? I think that's a fair question. So why would I want to find the narrow gate? And then third, even if I did want to find the narrow gate and walk through it, what's that look like exactly? What's entailed in that? What do I have to do? Do I have to sign up for something? Do I have to pay somebody? Do I have to grow a beard or join a cult or wear a robe of any kind? Can I still watch House of Cards? You know, what is involved in walking through the narrow gate? So those are the three questions I think we need to answer if we're going to make sense of the whole passage. So here we go. First of all, what's the narrow gate? In verse 13, Jesus says, enter through the narrow gate. What is that? What do you think it is? I didn't really grow up going to church. I know some of you grew up going to church. If you grew up going to church and you were in Sunday school when you were a kid, what was the right answer to every Sunday school question? Jesus, right? Who died for you? Jesus. Who made the world? Jesus. Who loves you the most? Jesus. Who is the best quarterback in the NFL? Jesus. Right? That's kind of how it worked. The right answer to everything is Jesus. Is that the right answer here? Is Jesus the narrow gate? It would kind of fit well together with that famous passage over in John 14:6, where Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me or through me. It would kind of fit with that. But I want us to be careful because maybe Jesus isn't saying the exact same thing here as he's saying over in John 14:6. I don't want to make him say the same thing here that he's saying over in John 14, because here it seems like he might be saying something different. Just a minute ago I said that right after he says what he says in verses 13 and 14, he explains what he means in verses 15 to 23. He uses these two word pictures and then kind of this scary warning. First word picture he uses in verse 10, he says, basically, look, sometimes wolves dress up like sheep. Right? Anybody watch Breaking Bad? It's a dumb question. Anybody not watch Breaking Bad? Really? Okay, well, there's good reasons for not watching Breaking Bad. Like, if you're blind, that's a good reason. Walter White, the main character in Breaking Bad, is this exactly, right? Guy looks like a nice, soft, geeky, tighty-whitey wearing high school teacher, but in reality, he's the devil, right? He's a wolf in sheep's clothing. He walks, talks, and acts one way when he's in polite company, and then he's a completely different thing in reality. Second word picture Jesus uses in verses 16 to 20, the good and bad trees. Good trees bear good fruit, he says, and bad trees bear bad fruit. And you can tell whether a tree's good or bad by the quality of the fruit, by the quality of the output, right? No one who owns an apple orchard is ever going to say, well, you know, this tree consistently bears terrible fruit. It's small, it's rotten, it tastes bad, but it's a really good apple tree, right? No one's ever going to say that. That's good trees bear good fruit. And then last, as we've already seen, Jesus says in verses 21 to 23, that some people are going to end up at some point saying to Jesus, you know, wait a second. I called you Lord. I believed in you. I did some miracles. I did an exorcism. I preached some sermons. I went on a mission trip. You know, I was really nice to people. I recycled. I voted. I gave blood. I drive a Prius. I tip 20% when the service is really good. And Jesus is going to say, I never knew you. And I really want to figure out how to make sure he doesn't say that to me. I want to make sure he says the other thing to me, the well done, good and faithful servant thing. And that's what this passage is meant to help us figure out how to do. So in light of all of that, what is the narrow gate? It's not Jesus. It's not quite the simple Sunday school answer in this case. It's not even really believing in Jesus or calling Jesus your Lord. Because I think that the people in verses 21 to 23, I think that they probably believed in Jesus in some sense, that they obviously called him their Lord. The narrow gate is the kind of life that flows from a genuine commitment to Jesus. I'll say that again. The narrow gate is the kind of life that flows from a genuine commitment to Jesus. The sermon title Pastor Phil assigned me was The Proof is in the Pudding. It's probably in your sermon bulletin there. That's the title of my message because Phil told me it was. And as soon as he gave it to me, I had one of those moments where I thought, what does that mean? You know, I understand we all probably know what the idea of it is, but what does that phrase actually mean? It's a bizarre phrase. The proof is in the pudding. So I looked it up. I wish I could do a Bill Cosby impression with the pudding thing. The proof is in the... I'm not even going to try. Proof is in the pudding. It actually dates back to a 14th century English proverb, and originally it was, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And back then, proof actually meant something more like test, and pudding wasn't the chocolatey stuff that Bill Cosby sells, probably not personally, but advertises. Pudding was actually a kind of sausage. It was like animal's intestines stuffed with minced meat and other delights. And so originally, proof is in the pudding. The proof is in the pudding meant something like you test a sausage by eating it, which I think is way catchier. Next time someone asks you, I think Johnny Manziel's going to be a good NFL quarterback? Hey, man, you test a sausage by eating it. Test a sausage. Okay. So the meaning of the proverb, obviously, is that when it comes to sausage, you can't go by outward appearance. You can't know whether a sausage is going to be delicious or awful or kill you, maybe, unless you taste it, unless you test it and find out what it's made of, literally. Same thing Jesus is saying here. He's saying that there's a kind of life that flows from a genuine commitment to Jesus, and that kind of life will inevitably flow from a genuine commitment to Jesus, as surely as good fruit will come from a good tree. There's no such thing as a good tree that consistently bears bad fruit. There's no such thing as a person who is genuinely committed to Jesus and does not live out the kind of life that flows from a genuine commitment to Jesus. There is no such thing as a genuine follower of Jesus who says, I'm just not that interested in what Jesus has to say about how to do life. Does that make sense? Are you tracking with that? There is such a thing as a person who says they're committed to Jesus but doesn't live it out. Just like in Jesus' illustration, there's such a thing as a wolf that dresses up like a sheep. And I think we all know that, right? We all know that one of Christianity's biggest image problems is hypocrisy. In fact, the last time I was here, I asked you guys, people who are outside the church, what are the most common things they say about Christians, about people who are in the church? And one of the things somebody shouted out was hypocrites, right? It's a very common conception because there are so many people who kind of like, yep, I'm good with Jesus. Jesus is my buddy. Jesus is my homeboy. I like him. But they don't want him to be their master. They don't want to hand over the keys completely, right? But a person who is genuinely committed to Jesus will be living the kind of life that flows from a genuine commitment to Jesus. Now, okay, as soon as I say that, I just want to be really careful and really clear here. What I'm about to say isn't what my sermon's really about, but if you don't hear anything else this morning other than what I'm about to say, that's okay. The kind of life that I'm talking about, This kind of life that flows from a genuine commitment to Jesus is not a perfect life by any stretch. It's not always going to be an exemplary life. It's definitely not going to be a sinless life. It's going to be a life full of screw-ups and letdowns. Take it from me. It's going to be a life of brokenness and healing, of demolition and renovation, of degradation and recreation, of sin and repentance. But it will be the kind of life that is distinctive in its commitment to the way of Christ. Which leads me to my second question. Why would you want to find the narrow gate and enter through it? Why would you want to commit yourself to Christ? Why would you want to live the kind of life that flows from a genuine commitment to Christ? And I'm going to tell you right off the bat that my answer to that question is not so you can go to heaven. That's an okay answer. That's the kind of the Sunday school answer. Why do you want to follow Jesus? Go to heaven. And that's fine. Thumbs up for heaven. That's great. Here's the problem. It's almost never the answer the Bible gives for why you should follow Jesus. It's almost never the answer Jesus gives for why you should follow Jesus. I think that's another pretty common misconception about Christians, is that what we do is we sacrifice the life that we would otherwise want to live so that we can get repaid in heaven someday. Yeah? That's almost never the answer the Bible gives. In the future, as you're reading through the Bible, whenever you come across something where it sounds like Jesus is talking about why to follow him, or when one of Jesus' disciples is talking about that, pay attention to what they say the reason is. You're not going to find very often that it's so that we can all go to heaven in the end. By the way, I think we're going to heaven in the end. But, all right, I'm going to set that aside. So why then? If it's not heaven, why would you want to commit to following Jesus and following his way of life? Let me read verses 13 and 14 again. Look at your Bible. He says, enter through the narrow gate. Why? Well, here's his answer. For wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow is the road that leads to what? Life, and only a few find it. Now, immediately some of you are thinking, okay, but you just said it's not heaven. Isn't, when he says destruction in verse 13, isn't that hell? Which would probably make life in verse 14 eternal life in heaven? Could be. But I doubt it. You know why? I'm going to get super geeky on you here. You ready? Guess how many times in the book of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the books that are use most similar language to Matthew. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, guess how many times this word, destruction, the Greek word is apaleia. I looked it up. That's the geek part. Guess how many times that word is used to refer to hell? Zero. Not ever. And Jesus talks about hell quite a bit. So you would think that if Jesus were talking about hell here, he'd use one of the words he usually uses to refer to hell, because he never uses this word to refer to hell. The only other place we find this word in Matthew is over in chapter 26, 8, where some of you are going to be familiar with this story. This woman comes up to Jesus while he's eating. He's sitting down at a table eating. And she comes up and she has got this really expensive jar of perfume, and she breaks it open and she pours it over his head, kind of like Gatorade cooler style. And do you remember this? Jesus' disciples are really angry. And they're like, that's really expensive perfume. We could have sold that and given the money to the poor. What a waste. Remember that? Guess what word they use for waste? Apaleia, destruction. In other words, what Jesus is saying in verse 13 is something like, wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to waste, that leads to a wasted life. In other words, wasting your life is really, really easy, and many people do it. That's what he's saying. Let me throw out an idea for you to think about. I'm not even really going to make an argument for it at this point. I just want to throw it out there. What if there's a specific design for human life? For like how you're supposed to do life. What if there's a specific design for what it's made to do, what it's made to be, how human life is supposed to work best? Just what if? I want to tell you a story. a few years ago, my mom was going to make dinner for her and my dad. And she decided she wanted to make hamburgers. And it was winter, so in winter, what do you make hamburgers on? George Foreman Grill. And so she, you guys familiar with this? This is kind of a young crowd. But George Foreman Grill, you know, it's the white and black grill. You plug it in, you open it up, you put the burger on there, you close it, and it grills both sides, right? It's awesome. That's what I grew up with. That's what kind of cook my mom was. So my mom pulls out the Foreman Grill. She heats it up. She balls up the patty. She puts it on the grill and closes the door. And right away, she can tell that something's not quite right here. Like, the door wouldn't close all the way, first of all. And then it starts to stink a little bit, and the meat starts to smoke, and it smells like kind of burning, smoke starting to fill up the kitchen. She's like, what in the world? She unplugs it and opens it up, and the meat is just like mangled and burnt. She's like, what in the world is going on? So she takes a fork and she scrapes it off, puts it on a plate, grabs another piece of meat, rolls it up, figures that the meat is the problem. Grabs another piece of meat, puts it on there, and this time she really mashes it closed, like really closes the thing hard. She figures maybe that's the problem. Next burger starts cooking, starts stinking, starts smoking worse than the first one. So she unplugs it, opens it up again, and the meat is just mangled. It's all burnt. It looks terrible. She's like, what is happening here? And all of a sudden, she looks at the meat on the plate, and it's got these like little charred, black, burnt squares all over it. And suddenly she realizes she's not cooking burgers with the George Foreman grill. She's cooking burgers with the waffle iron. So I mean, you can imagine. She's just like, it's just burger burnt in between the grooves. She didn't even try to salvage it. She threw the waffle iron away. She's just like, it's never going to be clean. That's wrecked. So can you make burgers with a waffle iron? You can try, but you're probably going to end up wasting the meat and wrecking the waffle iron. Waffle irons are awesome for making waffles. But when you try to do something else with them that they weren't designed to do, things go badly and you end up being featured in your son's sermon illustration. So where am I going with this? I think one of the biggest misconceptions about Christianity is that following Jesus, what you do when you sign up to follow Jesus is you sign up for this laundry list of arbitrary rules and list of no's, right? No lying, no getting drunk, no sex outside of marriage, no divorce, no. Just a bunch of no's. And why would anyone want to follow a guy who's all about no, right? No one wants to grow up with parents who are all about no. Some of us grew up with parents who had way too many completely arbitrary no's. And it drove us crazy. So why would you want to grow up and be an adult and then all of a sudden sign up for a God who's all about no? But that couldn't be further from the truth. The truth is that human life has a design and a purpose. It has a way of doing it best. And what God sees most of us doing with our lives is using a waffle iron to make hamburgers and wasting the meat and wrecking the waffle iron. That's all he says no to. He sees us doing it and he tries to speak to us very lovingly and say, I actually have this all figured out already. I designed it, and so I know the way to live life to the fullest, to live with the most peace and joy and happiness and flourishing and beauty and love and vigor and passion and purpose and meaning. And I want that for you. I even have an instruction manual for you on life called the Bible. And I even sent you someone to give you a perfect example of how to do it. His name's Jesus, he's my son, and if you pattern your life on his and listen to what he has to say and do it, your life will not be wasted. your life will be the fullest life, the most meaningful life, the most truly human life. That's what Jesus means in verse 14 when he says, small is the gate and narrow is the road that leads to life. Doesn't that make you, I mean, I'm a really critical reader. When you read that, don't you want to say, I already have life. My heart's beating. My brain works, sort of. I already have life. What are you talking about? You're going to give me life. What he means is life to the full. It's exactly the same thing as he says over in John chapter 10. He says, I have come so that, by the way, whenever Jesus says, I have come so that, I really want to pay attention. Because he's talking about his big why. You know, in my company, we talk, in Keller Williams, we talk about the big why. Like, what's everyone's big why? What is, why do you do what you do? Why do you make the choices you make? What's your big why? This is Jesus' big why. I have come so that they may, what? Have life, but not just your heart beating, have life and have it to the full, is what he says. That's Jesus' big why. That you may have life and have it to the full. So did he come to give us arbitrary rules? Did he come to give us a big list of no's? Did he come to make sure we don't have a life so he can enforce his vindictive rule upon us? No, he came so that we'd have the fullest life possible. He came so that we'd stop making a mess of ourselves and others, not waste our lives, but live our life to the full, which is to live in the way of Christ, adopting his purpose, his practices, his priorities in life. Now, don't get me wrong. Does following the way of Christ ever mean that God says no to things that we want? Of course it does. Do parents who really love their kids ever say no to them? Of course. When I know that my little boy or girl is doing something that ultimately is going to be bad for them or is going to hurt themselves or others, I say no to it, not because I don't love them or trying to control or inhibit their life, but because I do love them and because I want their lives to be as full and happy as possible. And here's the thing. If you don't have kids, probably haven't experienced this yet, but sometimes kids don't understand why you're saying no. They can't possibly fathom what reason you could have for not letting them eat the whole box of Oreos. Why would you say no to this? What kind of dad's so vindictive? He's so unfair. Wouldn't a loving dad want us to have as many Oreos as would make us happy? And it's so hard to explain childhood diabetes and how it works to a four-year-old. Right? I mean, isn't that how we work? And wouldn't a loving God allow me? I mean, that's how we work. And my hope as a father is that even when I have to say no, my hope is that they'll understand that even if they don't get it, they have every confidence that I'm saying no because I love them. Because I know better than them what's good for them and what's going to hurt them. And that's all God desires for us. That's all he desires for us. That we would say, sometimes I don't get why God says no to stuff. I don't get it. It doesn't make sense to me. But I trust that it's because he knows better than me what's going to be good for me and what's going to hurt me. Because he designed me, and so he knows me best. Which I get. That's a huge leap of faith. That's an incredibly humbling thing to say. To say, maybe I don't know best what's best for my life. So, why would we want to find the narrow gate and enter through it? So that our lives would not be wasted, but will be the fullest lives, the most meaningful lives, the most truly human lives. Okay, last question. Say we're all on board with this. I'm not assuming we are, but just if you're on board with what I've been saying, and we think, yeah, that makes sense to me. I get that. Jesus came to show us the best way to live, and that way of life is the life that flows from a genuine commitment to Jesus. So okay, now what? Verse 13, Jesus says, enter through the narrow gate. Verse 14, small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. So how do you find it? What's the narrow gate? How can we have this kind of life that we've been talking about? What does a genuine commitment to Jesus look like? Let me start again by telling you what it's not. It's not getting more religious. It's not trying to lead a better life. It's not going to church more. Even though I think that being a part of a community of people who are trying to do this life together is incredibly important. That's all church is. But genuine commitment to Jesus, living life to the full as a result, entails three things. It entails believing that Jesus is who he says he is. Believing that he did what he said he did, namely dying for our failures and rising to life again to bring us life, true life. And genuine commitment to Jesus means believing that he always knows what's best for us and for our lives. Always. Not some of the time, all the time. Even when we, like children, don't really understand why he says or why he's saying it. Commitment means following him, but not the way you follow someone on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or whatever. What do you do when you follow someone on social media? You kind of half pay attention to what they say. You know, if they say something you really like, you like it. If they say something you don't like, you don't like it. You kind of get some updates on their life. Maybe you actually even dialogue once in a while, but what you don't do is adopt their pattern of life. You don't do what they do and start saying what they say, thinking like they think, right? Unless you're way too hooked on Facebook. But that's what it means to follow Jesus. It means to have faith in, trust in, belief in, commitment to, whatever word you want to use for it, to Jesus. And that's why it doesn't work to go part of the way with Jesus. It doesn't work. You know, when people say, yeah, I like the whole being generous thing. I like the whole love your enemies thing. I like the do unto others thing. But the rest of it, I don't know. I think I'm just going to figure out my own way. That's basically Facebook. That's like, I like that one. Like, don't like that. Like that one. Don't like that. Don't like that. Like that one. Doesn't work that way with Jesus. Can we do that? Of course. Of course you can. Millions of people do. But that's like trying to cook a burger on a waffle iron. What you're going to get is a few burnt squares on a patty. But overall, you're going to make a mess. We're going to make a mess of ourselves and of others. And that's not God's design or desire for us. Our design is to live the fullest life possible by trusting in Christ, by following him, by patterning our life on his, and maybe most importantly, by relying on him and his sacrifice on the cross. Especially when the pattern of our life doesn't quite match up with the pattern of his life. Which, of course, is every day. That's why Christians make such a big deal of Jesus' death. Jesus' life is our pattern, but Jesus' death is so important because we realize how often the pattern of our life doesn't match with the pattern of his life, right? Jesus' death for us is God saying, it's okay. It's okay that you're not perfect. If the church, if the community of the followers of Jesus were only for perfect people or only for really cleaned up, well put together people, membership would be zero. But the church is the community of the broken made new. It's the community of seekers and followers. It's the community of people who know that they are God's renovation projects. There aren't any sparkling mansions in this room. If you think you are, you're wrong. You don't know yourself well enough, and you don't know Jesus well enough. We're all renovation projects. We're all people who are learning the rhythms of God and the patterns of Christ as we trust in him and model our lives in him. So, I'm out of time. Here's the question that we each have to wrestle with this morning. I think they're obvious and they're very simple. Not easy, but simple. Will you enter through the narrow gate? Do you believe that the wide and broad road, the easy road that you kind of make up as you go along, may in fact lead to a wasted life? Do you believe that the small gate and narrow road, the life that flows from a genuine commitment to Christ, actually leads to the fullest life? The life most filled with peace and joy and happiness and flourishing and beauty and love and vigor and passion and purpose and meaning. Do you believe that? If you do, today can be the first day when you take a step onto that road, or maybe step back onto the road after wandering on other paths for a while. I'm going to, I think I got a minute here. I just want to let us be quiet for a minute. Is that okay? I just want to stop talking. And I know that some people are really uncomfortable with silence, but I like making people uncomfortable. So why don't we just be quiet for a minute or two and just let's let our thoughts sink in. Whatever was useful to you in this few moments, whatever kind of stuck in your head, maybe just think on that. Maybe see if God might even talk to you a little bit. And then I'll wrap us up in prayer in just a minute or two.